Hey guys, welcome to another podcast episode. This is episode 128 of the Actual Fluency Podcast. And today I'm chatting with Mike Campbell from Glossika. And we have a really good all-around discussion about really language learning at its core, but specifically focusing on how to learn effectively and using repetition to build up your skill. And this is, of course, reflected very much in Mike's product, which is Glossika, where you can get started with a free trial on tryglossika.com. Give it a chance there, and if you like it, it's a monthly subscription that gets you access to all the 50 languages. But Mike is an extremely interesting character. He knows so much about language learning, and in the episode, your head might start spinning a little bit from all the linguistic and academic references he gives, which is a little bit unusual on this show. Normally, certainly speaking for myself, I mostly speak out of anecdotal evidence or from what people have experienced. But Mike actually has both. He also has the academic background, the studies that show why certain things work. And it's obviously no secret that Glossika is the sponsor of the show, but I actually think that we succeeded in making a really interesting program for you today that doesn't really involve Glossika that much. Glossika is kind of a tool to, you know, learn the languages. It's a tool to that, according to the philosophy of the software, is efficient in doing so. But it's not required necessarily for what we talk about here. We talk a lot about input versus output, and we talk a lot about the value of repetition, the value of context, and Mike shares a lot of general tidbits and advice. So well worth the listen. I hope you really enjoy it. And like I said, if you want to give Glossika a try, say Chris sent you, and they'll take good care of you at tryglossika.com. And it's spelled G-L-O-S-S-I-K-A. So give that a try and let me know what you think. And enjoy the episode with Mike Campbell. It's been basically ages since we last talked. It was February 2015, so that's over 3 years ago. So obviously people have forgotten everything we said back then. So we can just, if we just slide the old recording in now, we can go have a coffee break, be back in an hour. No, of course not. But for the people who don't know Mike Campbell, do you want to just give them a quick run through of your backstory, how you got into languages, and then tell us a little bit about what Glossika is as well?
Yeah, I was just thinking about the last 3 years, and some things feel like they move very slowly. And some other things feel like they move quickly. So, yeah, there have been quite a lot of changes since then. But all in all, I mean, we're still on the same path to just delivering more content for languages and language learning. So originally, I started off with, and just like you had just alluded to before we started the interview, was that I've also done some work with some more obscure languages. But I think that the reason why I did that was just kind of to test some theories about language learning, because it's one thing where you can go to the store and buy, you know, one of these Routledge colloquial or teach yourself books and learn a language from a book, and you have all of the grammar laid out for you, and it's really nice, and maybe even a CD and recordings. But what happens if I think you really test your abilities, like if you go into some mountainous area or a jungle and you come across a tribe, and can you learn their language? So you've learned some tricks from these books, and you've learned maybe one or two languages. So I think it's the true test of this whole idea of an obscure language is it's nice to be able to say, well, we would like to help these languages, you know, be able to thrive in the modern world and with technology. But I think it's another thing is that do your methods, is there any grounding for these methods? And so can they actually help me acquire a language where there are no resources available? And if I'm just actually going in there face to face, you know, and it would be, of course, it'd be nice to maybe travel to Siberia and try this in somewhere else. And I don't have the ability to travel to some places and try that. But I think that here in my backyard, there are a few languages. Since I live in Taiwan, there are a few languages that we have access to here and that I could go and try this. So that's kind of been the idea behind this whole language learning, is that can you learn a language without the text, without materials, and without reading from a book? Can you do it with just sound, with just audio? And if that audio is in place, you know, like one of the earliest methods I used is I would take a whole set of sentences and just pieces of ideas, not just vocabulary, but just like these pieces of ideas, and reconstruct them and have them record these. And I would listen to these recordings again and again to pick it up. And I found that you could really, there's a lot of talk these days in artificial intelligence and AI and in machine learning. And there's this concept called a black box. For example, if you want to teach a car how to drive autonomously on its own, you give it a basic set of instructions, you know, stay within the lines of the road and use cameras to view. But then the whole learning itself happens inside of a black box. And so this black box is actually the humans. We don't really know what the car is doing specifically while it's learning, but it is learning to stay within the lines and turn corners and do all these other functions. And so I believe that there is some aspect of our brain that is a black box, but if you don't build a foundation for that learning, then the brain doesn't really pick up the patterns and learn. So for example, you could watch some TV programs for 20 years in a foreign language, but you'd never pick up anything because you just haven't given it any sort of foundation for picking up the patterns. Mm-hmm. Right. So a lot of people, they think, well, just mass exposure to lots of media really helps. Well, it doesn't really help unless you already understand something and you're just adding a little bit every time. Because if your understanding is near zero, then you're actually not adding anything at all.
So how do you get started then? Is that the Routledge we were talking about, or?
Right. So you're asking how I got started?
Well, we can talk about that as well. So there's just a little bit of echo. I don't know if you changed anything. I can hear myself in the recording. Is it gone now? Maybe it's okay.
I can turn my volume down.
just for as much as you can hear me still. No, I was just wondering, because that concept is something that I've been dealing with a little bit lately as well, is this idea of we have a basic set of ways to learn languages. The brain has a natural way of assimilating, but that works very well when you're a baby, because that's when you need to learn it. But when you're an adult, I feel like a lot of times people either do way too much sort of fake stuff. Like, let's say I'm on Duolingo all day. I mean, that's not really going to get me to use the language at all. Or people will just sit and watch films, or, you know, just listen to stuff, which is very useful. But again, it doesn't create that language. It doesn't build the skills needed. So what the question that I that immediately sprung to mind is, if I need a basis or a foundation to begin to build something off of that native material, or the listening or the shadowing, what is that foundation in your mind anyway, that people can effectively use to start out the right way? Is it textbooks if they're available? Is it some of them, you know, really beginner friendly content? Is it a kids fairy tales? What can people do to start out with?
Yeah, I think that there's actually two sections that we could talk about in that question. First of all, I mean, you could go onto the Glossika platform that we built and try a lot of languages that maybe you've never even heard of. got things in there like Kurdish and I don't know what languages people might not have heard of before. maybe like Bengali, even though that's a national language. Maybe some people have never heard of it. But you could go on there and try it, and then in my mind, it should be able to give you some of that foundation so that you can actually move forward. But I would say that Glossika probably has a really hard starting point for people that don't have experience with languages. I often say the hardest language in the whole world to learn is the first foreign language you
learn.
Right. And it gets easier after that. So if you fail at the first one, don't worry. Try another one. Try two more. You might as well make the first one really, really hard anyway, because everything after that's easier in comparison. Right. So like I said, there are kind of two parts to that question, if I can remember exactly what I was thinking about. The first thing would be that to build that foundation. Okay, so the first thing I wanted to mention real quick was just the input output part. So what you're saying, it's you can get a lot of input, but actually creating the output is very difficult. And I think that has to do with environment, that has to do with your own motivation and whatnot. But if you're just getting a lot of input, there may not be that push or impetus to actually create the output. And so this is where shadowing is actually really good. So even if you're not pronouncing things out loud, but you're moving your tongue and you're kind of mimicking like how a baby does, this is actually building muscle memory. The tongue is a muscle, so move it as much as you can, and then start to mumble your words and start to make some sounds. And even if you sound really silly in the beginning, it's kind of okay, because that is actually part of the process. It's like learning to swim or, you know, learning to sing. You're just going to sound really silly at the beginning, but after 1,000 hours of singing practice, you probably start sounding much better. And so, you know, that's the first thing, is that the output really depends on muscle memory. And so I like to think of our tongue as falling into, for some listeners who may not be familiar with English, we have a word called a rut, which is the wheels of the carriage that leave the line in the road. And so we say things that where you fall into a rut, which means you fall into this one line that just gets deeper and deeper, you know, and you're always following that one line. But I think that our tongue, when we are babies, they fall into like maybe 3 or 4 or 5 ruts in our mouth. And so our tongue position always hits those exact same positions every time when we speak. So my T's and S's are always going to be one position. My K's and G's are always going to be in another position. And it's really hard to kind of adjust outside of those ruts over time. And so learning a new language actually forces us to learn new positions and ruts. And that's why, you know, learning the second and the third and fourth language gets easier, because the pronunciation just matches with something you've already been doing. You already have new ruts in there. And so that muscle memory is really important. So that's the first part of your question. Now, let me see if I can remember the second part of your question. Okay, so building the groundwork. For example, my belief is basically that you have to have a way for the brain as a black box to start doing pattern recognition. And so when you're doing a lot of input, whether that's media, TV, radio, and whatnot, you just don't have the ability to do pattern recognition on a mass amount of conversation. If you take a small child who's 3 years old and you start talking to them about politics and the elections and everything else that is going on TV, for the child, that's just noise. And the child is not, for the child, it's like us listening to a foreign language. There's nothing that they understand. But if you go up to the child, you say, do you want to eat? Are you hungry? You want to go to sleep? Then the child can interact and start, you know, understands, because you're speaking at a level that is really important to their life. First of all, like, yes, I have these feelings inside of me and you're addressing them, and I feel excited because I understand and I'm communicating. And then at some point the language grows and grows and grows until they're able to talk about politics and everything else. But that's not going to happen for a 3-year old. And so we are very much like 3-year olds. And so you have to really start off with pattern recognition. And so what we do at Glossika is we build pattern recognition really comes down to syntactic structures. It's a fancy word, which just means word order. And so the funny thing about these programs, there's a lot of apps out there and a lot of new ones coming on the market that are really just, they're kind of fun, and you got fancy sounds and little things you can match, and this is great. But they really focus on vocabulary building.
Right. Yeah.
The vocabulary building is just, I would say it's, you know, it's a very small portion of language learning. I think vocabulary building is important, so go ahead and do that. And as long as you feel engaged and you feel like it's fun, then you're enjoying the process and you're learning, that's great. But when it actually comes to communicating, where you put the words in the sentence are also very important. And when the words appear in a different position in the sentence, you have different grammar starting to affect those words and they change, you know. So this is really important as well. And you can't really learn that from just learning vocabulary.
Right.
You know, if I'm learning a language that has older grammatical forms from the old European structure, where it has genitive and locative declensions and accusative and dative declensions, and it has this vestige of this older grammar in it that we don't have in English anymore. But then you're going to be faced with a problem with, well, do I learn all this grammar first and then I learn how to speak and I learn how to apply it to every single vocabulary word that I'm learning? But actually I found that a lot of that grammar, it doesn't actually appear on every single vocabulary word. And so some vocabulary words, they have a specific grammar in a specific situation. And if you just learn that, and then you start learning a lot of phrases with a similar structure, you actually get the grammar intact as you're speaking, just as a child does. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you ask a five-year-old child who speaks Lithuanian, which word is dative case? The child doesn't have no idea. But they are actually creating it naturally, because they mimic their surroundings and it makes sense to them, because in that specific word order or syntax, it just comes out and it flows right. Okay, so this is the basic idea, is that you have to build up the foundation where you give them simple structures where they're mimicking the word order with the grammar intact. And so that when they speak these very simple sentences, whether they're I'm hungry, I'm tired, or I'm thirsty, they're actually creating the predicate form with the correct grammar intact. And so you start building off of that. And so there's basically, you know, about a dozen major areas of syntactic growth that you have to go through to really build out your fluency. And so that was just the very first step.
Yeah, it's funny. I talk about this a lot, about learning in context, that, you know, in languages like Russian or other declensive languages, you have phrases are rarely going to be, I mean, that you have phrases that are used so much, and that therefore learning that case will not be like learning the declension table. It would just be like, okay, if I want to say this, this is the ending that I'm going to use. And for me, that just makes a huge difference, because let's say you're learning Russian vocabulary. Well, you're suddenly learning, I mean, what is it? 8 forms of the word. Some of them are the same.
For example, if I say, I don't even have to think that I'm going to say that in genitive case. It just comes out.
Yeah, exactly.
Automatically.
Because you've got that pattern. You've got that experience seeing that kind of pattern of words next to each other. I think that's really useful, because when I started, I would do a lot of flashcards, which are very effective, I will say, you know. But I don't think they work very well for those kind of languages. I guess that's another problem we can maybe address. If I'm learning, let's say, an easier language, maybe like Danish, my native language, we don't really have any kind of declension or cases or anything. Like, we have 2 cases, but, you know, they're not really, there's no rule for it, so you can't really learn it. You can't say words ending in this should be that and words ending in this should be that. It's just...
So do you learn the rules specifically when you go to school?
But there are no rules. It's just part of learning the gender of a word. Either it's this or it's that. And because we only have...
They teach you this specific grammar in school as a child? You have to do exercises and...
No.
No.
You just know.
You just say it naturally, huh?
Yeah, you just know. Like, you just know. I mean, people still make mistakes with this. And there are new words coming in from English that are being, you know, danglified. And there's always a huge debate whether it's one or the other, because there are no fixed rules. There's no, like, spelling or anything to do with form. So if I had to compare those two languages, I would first of all say Danish, objectively, is a lot easier than Russian. You know, I know some people have a hard time kind of comparing languages, which is fair enough, because if you're, let's say, a Serbian, then Russian is probably easier than Danish. But right. let's say for me, anyway. And the thing is, if I was learning Danish through flashcards, I would probably do a really good job because there's not that many variations. I mean, the words are the same anyway because right. we don't use endings. We put it in front anyway. So there's only one way. There's only one way to say the word, which is great. But if I'm learning Russian, there could be up to 8 ways. And let's say I yeah. have to learn all of them because I'm being a completionist or idiot, I guess you can say. I'm suddenly spending 8 times as long learning the words, meaning I learn 8 times as little, and I don't even need it.
Because not only that,
you don't. Not only that, them.
But the the declensions in Russian will change from word to word. And so you'll have a masculine declension that sometimes it has an O ending and sometimes has a ye ending.
There you go. Exceptions.
And,
yeah.
And I think that if you actually, I've been writing a little bit about this, about these grammatical details of Russian, in that if you actually treat the there's actually a very interesting relationship between the O and the ye. And it really just has to do with the palatalization in the word. So a lot of that can just be determined. I mean, it would actually flow out very easily. And the O is actually always a weak consonant. So it's always an U. And there's also a complex relationship between the O and the Y and the Yo, mm-hmm. which is the accented palatalized O. But it actually is an E with an umlaut or a diresis.
Yeah.
And so this is actually, it actually is a, the... If you go deep, deep, deep into the grammar, into the history of the language, it's actually an O that is palatalized, and now it's has an accent, and so you don't really realize it because it's spelled like with a letter E, and so this is it can be kind of confusing. But there's actually this complex relationship between them, and then if you actually learn the language speaking in a more of a fluent way, in a relaxed way, rather than memorizing all of the declensions and the rules. You actually kind of create the right endings naturally.
Yeah, you can hear it eventually. You know,
you don't really need to think about it because it's almost impossible to switch over to an O when it's already palatal because it just doesn't flow. So I think memorizing all those endings is actually you're hurting yourself by
definitely.
You're building walls for yourself in learning because you're just gonna get frustrated really, really fast.
Yeah,
and if you just relax and let it flow, you have to mimic exactly how the native speaker does it. But by doing that, you actually feel the right endings always flowing out easiest.
Yeah, but I think it comes from school. I think it comes from the rote learning in school where you're just meant to learn all the conjugation tables. I remember learning it for German. we did phrases going through all the. You know, der, den, das, dem, and all the different article conjugations. And I didn't really learn it, to be honest. I speak German quite well, but I make a lot of these gender mistakes and grammar ending mistakes. Even if we spend a lot of
time. I still remember, I can still chant it. Der, die, das, dem, der, dem, der, dem, des, der, des.
There you go. You had it as well. But I remember.
I think I can recite it as well.
And you've got the what are they called, the prepositions that take certain cases as well, right. And these are just examples of, in my opinion, a way of taking language learning, which is a really natural process, and turn it into something like math, which is something we just kind of made right. up. You know, this, as far as I know, anyway, I'm not an expert on math, but to me, there's nothing really that natural about math. We, of course, you can find math in nature. But
right.
the understanding of math, I believe, is, as far as I know, entirely made up. Like we decided that's.
Well, I know a few mathematicians, and I've never heard them speak fluent mathematics.
There you go.
They can write things down on paper and show you, but they don't really speak it fluently.
Right. There you go. So that's,
and even when they write it down, I still don't understand it. But
yeah, I have no idea. Yeah, but that just shows you it must be a terrible way to learn a language, like doing it like math, because nobody speaks fluent math.
And nobody speaks fluent math. But interestingly, though, and if you look at this, there's a really good parallel here, and that is that math does describe nature. It is a It is a way that we can encode all of the, you know, the physics and the science of nature. And actually writing is the same thing. It's like we're encoding the science of our language and writing it down. We're recording it just as we are recording the physical, you know, mathematical, of nature. And so in a way, you know, writing is sort of a construct. And it doesn't really, and I believe seriously that writing is actually, you take time to revise and rewrite and redo all of your writing and your prose and your essays. And you do this many times and make your writing better and better. But few people that I know of can actually stand up and speak with excellently written prose directly out of their brain.
It's very different.
So few people can actually are fluent in that way either.
Yeah, no, it's hard. Yeah, for sure. But so what as a founder of a language software company, how do you deal with that difficulty of just how different the languages are? Because on your site you have Danish, you have Russian, you have Bengali. You know, you have such different kind of languages. How do you face up to those challenges of teaching fundamentally the same? I mean, it's a language, you know, people speak right, it, people right. It's communication, but they have such different moving parts, because for me, I wouldn't even know where to begin with that. That must be a huge challenge.
Well, you know, if you have a child at the age of 12 months in any country in the world, and then from 12 months to 36 months, the third birthday, all children in the world, they're basically going through the exact same process in different countries, in different environments, with different languages, but they're all experiencing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And by 36 months, they speak 600 words, at least. Every child, even the slow learners, will have maybe at least 500 words that they can speak. And they probably understand maybe up to 1,000 more, which mm-hmm. they start slowly integrating into their speech in the following years. And so every three-year-old child has this active vocabulary of about 600 words. And so it happens across all languages. Now, I don't know about the bilingual child. Maybe the bilingual child has some slower capacity with both languages, but they start to appear later. I haven't seen any studies on that specifically, but I know for monolingual speakers, it's like that. And so we actually know what vocabulary they learn in what order for most children. I mean, they actually start producing certain words at a certain month. And there's a great study by Stanford University that has done this. And it's a study that covers about 20 different languages from around the world. So it's quite comprehensive. And their numbers are higher for Chinese, but as a Chinese speaker, I think that they're counting words differently. Okay. I think that the number is still the same. You know, they're probably counting individual characters, but I still believe it's the same. So I find that, you know, language learning really is the same for every child around the world. So when you ask me the question, how do we, you know, I think we look at it as how does a child learn a language, mm-hmm. and what prepares the mind to be able to pick up that data. So we're not children and we learn languages differently. We think about things, but we also want to address the basic issues of human life, which is, you know, I'm hungry or I'm tired. And we kind of start off with those kinds of words and we build it out from there. And then we start talking about what your daily activities are. What are you planning for next week? What did I do yesterday? And all of these kinds of things. And we work through all of these activities. And now that's content related. I mean, we could actually create all kinds of different, we could change our content completely. We could change every single sentence in our database. And it wouldn't change how we actually deliver the content. We deliver the content in the same way.
Right.
But what philosophy does is we actually break down the structures of every single language and we sort them. So this is the difference from our 2015 version from 3 years ago, is that, which was a static book form. Today it's you know, every language is delivered a little bit differently, and algorithm figures out the sorting for that based on that language's different kinds of complexity. And what is the easiest way to acquire these specific concepts. So every sentence, it actually has a deep, what I would call a syntacto-semantic layer, which is different than the surface layer. The surface layer is what you actually hear. And so every word, every sentence actually has that underlying syntacto-semantic framework. And so from that framework, one common example I give is that you could say an accident happened. Mm-hmm. In English, we say the accident first and we say the happened second, but the accident is not an agent in the sentence. The accident did not do anything. The accident occurred. It is an existential verb. So the existential verb means that it just existed. It came into existence. You could say come into existence a problem or an accident, you know, and this sort of encodes it how maybe an Aborigine speaker would speak in his own language. But if you look at the Russian, you can't say the word order in the same way that we do in English, even though Russian is typically subject verb object. You say you don't say avaria произошло, you say произошло авария. And it's not аварию, it's not in the accusative, it's still in the nominative. You say авария. And so some learner of the language might say, well, why do you say произошло? Произошло is obviously conjugated for a neutral form. It's not conjugated for, you're not saying произошла. It's not for the авария. It happened. It happened. It's it. Произошло. Yeah. And then the авария happens. And then the авария is just a theme for the sentence. So the theme is just like a third party in the sentence. It doesn't really, it's not a subject. It's not an object. So if you use a sort of subject-object learning pattern for everything, you're just going to get really confused. And then in a lot of languages, you have these actions that happen that are related to the body that we don't really control. So for example, a lot of things are like you fall asleep or you cough or you sneeze or you wake up. And these are just a lot of things that happen with the body that we don't really control. They just happen. And so in English, we always use the I. I did it. I coughed. But you're not really the agent. You didn't control it, or, you know, it just happened to you. And so in a lot of languages, that I is actually a me.
Yeah.
And so we have to group these kinds of sentences into their own group. Like bodily functions are in their own group, because maybe in that language, you want to be able to pick up the pattern. And not, you're not learning it in some other pattern, which is subject, verb, and object, where you're mixing it up with a bunch of other sentences, because then you're just going to get confused. It's like, why suddenly, sometimes the I is now a me, and sometimes, you know, I'm getting confused. Why is this? But if you separate all of the sentences by the very deep grammar, which is what is the interrelationship between all of the parties involved in the sentence, and do they fall into a certain class? So there's a kind of verb called a semilfactive verb. And a semilfactive verb is something that happens once, and it happens, and it's gone. It's done. For example, maybe my cup of coffee here, it falls onto the ground and shatters. So fall, it's a semilfactive verb, because unless I take a snapshot in time, while it is falling, but normally if you ask me what happened to your coffee, I would say it fell. I wouldn't say it was falling. You can't even say that. You can't even put it into the continuous tense. It was falling.
Right.
Maybe I could if it was falling for a long time and the telephone rang. And it was falling and the telephone rang. You know? But it actually just happens really fast. Or even when it shatters. A shatter is a semilfactive verb. And so you don't have these verbs happening in the continuous tense. So if you're learning Russian, you're not going to have the imperfective form of these verbs. You're only going to have the perfective form of these verbs.
Mm, yeah, that's another point. Yeah.
And so a lot of students, they actually confuse, you know, they might be learning Spanish or French or German, and they get confused. You know, you have perfect verbs, or the present perfect and the past perfect. And then in the Slavic languages, you have perfective and imperfective. And what is the difference? Is there a difference between these? And the answer is yes, because a perfective verb, the perfective verb actually means that an action is finished. But in the Western European languages, perfect means that it is both time and finish. So there is both a time element and the completion of the action built into one verb.
But isn't that super hard to teach, though? Because
it's really hard to teach because students, they
use a translation, let's say.
So you have to
translate the same way.
Right. You have to break up the patterns into different groups. And so if you say that something happened at a certain, over a certain period of time, for example, in English, I could say it happened this week, or it has happened once in the last month, or something like this. You know, how you have a period of time attached to it. And the German is a little bit less strict about this. You could say that it happened on Friday. You know, I'm trying to remember my German here.
Well, yeah, I'm not. No,
it's hard. It's hard. I'm Freitag. You know.
Passiert.
Maybe. Yeah, and then you could say, and then you could use the present perfect form there. But it is actually referring to a point previous in time. Whereas the Russian, it doesn't really have, because right now my Russian is probably fresher in my mind than my German. But the Russian is actually focused more on the completed action and less on the time. And so that is what perfective is. And so the imperfective is like the imperfect, except that the imperfect encodes the time. And so it's always in the past. So the imperfect is I was doing.
Yeah.
Like you have in Spanish and French, you know. And in Russian, the imperfective is not I was doing. It is I am doing and I was doing. You have to add the tense to it. And so the perfective, in the perfective in Russian, you don't have a present tense. It can be the future. Because I will do it means I am certain that I will go and complete this action.
Yeah.
Я почитаю книгу. I will go and read this book to completion.
Yeah. Well, that makes it really hard to learn Russian, for instance. But I just wondered with the, if you use primarily, let's say, a translation, how do you explain the difference between Я читаю книгу, Я почитаю книгу?
Well,
if
you
just
need
says
to have,
red,
you or, have the translation set up right.
Okay.
You know?
We'll read, I guess. Or I read the book. I was reading the book. Maybe that's the difference.
Maybe
it's not as complicated as that, so make it out.
Have you read this book? And so I think, you know, normally we would just translate it as a perfective.
Did you finish it? Yeah.
Because normally when you ask somebody a question, you know, I have a book sitting here somewhere. Okay, so have you read this book? This is a great book. In conversation, people are only going to use one form.
Yeah.
That I'm not gonna go and ask you, were you reading this book? Were you reading this book? He's like, I was reading it, but I finished it. You know, in English we don't ask that.
Right.
In any language, people don't ask the question like that. Were you reading this book? Unless there's something more to the sentence. You have to have something more to the. So in this case, when you're learning these complex verb forms in different languages, there really has to be more to the sentence in order to actually use that verb. So memorizing these verbs in like out of context can be quite confusing, mm-hmm. And it's just like memorizing the declension table because you're not really understanding when the verb is actually being used, and in what context. But
right.
if you always learn почитать in that kind of context, then you think that, well, I know how to use it in this context. And so if I hear it in a different, if I hear the imperfective in another context, then I understand that it's outside of the context that I've learned. So it must have the other meaning.
That's interesting. And also one thing I'm thinking while we're talking a lot about giving examples from English, and I keep thinking how hard English must be to learn if you're not, let's say, from languages that are similar, because English is so, that's a...
Yeah, to tell you the truth, the Slavic languages have a very simple verb structure compared to the Western languages. And so it's actually much more difficult for them to learn the complex verb structures, especially in English. That's true.
Yeah, I was thinking you said, fall asleep. Obviously, that's natural for us, but if you're learning, it's like fall asleep. All these what do you call them? Fixed expressions, and I really respect people who are learning English, and it's the most, I think it's the most learned language in the world, as a second language anyway. And so that must be quite a challenge. Do you have an English course? Is it any different from the other courses? Do you do anything differently to serve that market rather than the other languages?
Yeah, actually, we have the English course, I think, is one of our top popular courses. And of course, they can choose between British and American English that we have on the site. But
Oh, that's
I don't
nice.
know the exact numbers between them. But I think added up, it's probably one. I think our top languages happen to be French, Spanish, and English. And a lot of others that follow close behind. Everything that you can learn in school are basically your top languages: German, Japanese, and Chinese, maybe, and Italian.
Yeah, and these are the popular choices everywhere, whether it's
Right.
Duolingo or Teach Yourself or
Right.
whatever you look into. So I can definitely understand that. It's cool to see though that a lot of people are doing well in English as well. I really like, it's one of my favorite languages for sure. The flexibility in the speech, that also makes it difficult. The nuances, the small differences between choosing that word over another word or how you say things, it makes it extremely hard. But I think what I just wanted to add with Glasgow is we talked about 3 years ago. We were talking 2015. You were talking about theoretically, or as a fundamental principle, how sentence-based learning works. And I think just in the 3 years, I think most people who have been part of the community for a little bit while are starting to pick up on this now. They're starting to understand that language is not just these fractured pieces of vocabulary that just comes together. It's really just getting the context, the kind of the pattern recognition that we talked about. And what I found r really cool about the new Glasgow, do you call it the AI version or is this just the URL? I guess I don't know how to distinguish the two, but the online version that you have now, I think is fantastic compared to the old one. I know that the sort of the core idea is the same, but having just listening to files and stuff, it was really kind of a tedious process. Whereas now you just log in and you just press a button and there's even, hands-free, you just sit back and it just kind of goes through the reps for you. I think
This is what I
that's
wanted to
really
build
cool.
like years ago, but we've always had trouble looking for developers to join the team, and so when we had people join the team, we built it. And so I'm still looking for developers because this is about like maybe one fourth of the whole platform that I want to build. But yeah, there's a lot more things that we would like to push out.
Yeah, I
But
want to
this
add.
is what I always had in mind from the very beginning, and I think that the just publishing was a very first step. But it wasn't the ideal thing, with the packaged MP3 files, and it was very tedious to try to explain how to open up. And I just thought, a program or even an app that just does all of this automatically for you would be really great. An app is something that we're moving towards, of course, but it takes time and it takes a lot of investment to be able to get people on board and they understand how to build the technology is really a tough thing. Most developers, they don't know much about language in general, and so some of their preconceptions are not exactly what we want to build. And so there's a lot of communication that has to go on in building that.
Sure. And what I've seen also is you've added a lot of new ways to interact with the material. There's some new tools out there, some new, I don't know if you want to call them games, maybe. Maybe that's a little bit too much appified, but there's definitely new tools of going through the materials. What kind of, how did you come up with that to, you have your basic principle that you go through those sentences, the materials, you get the pattern recognition. And now I can go in and I can do these kind of, well, yeah, almost games like, let's call it what they are. And when did you start doing those, and where did they come from? Because that's what I see a lot in other apps and in kind of the new modern world is they want to gamify everything. So how did you add
well, those things? You know, you'll see those supplementary training modules below the main training, which is start your session.
Right.
And so we're not able to roll those out for every language because there are some peculiarities with that specific language that might make that not work properly. And so we're still working through that to make sure that we, you know, there's some things that we have to do specifically for some languages.
Sure.
And like we're revising the romanization on a few languages so that when we do like the, there's something where we ask you to write out the language based on the romanization. So it actually trains you to be able to go from like, or maybe you hear this is a dictation. You hear the language and you're supposed to type it out exactly with the right spelling and all of that. But in some cases, we just show you the IPA or we show you some other transcription and then you're supposed to, or romanization. So for example, I might write the sentence out in pinyin, in Chinese pinyin, and then you're supposed to write it out and you're supposed to type out the characters, which actually tests your ability to read and write Chinese. This is not really a core component of Glossika because we actually just train you for the speaking and listening, but it's something that a lot of people they've asked for. They want to have that supplementary training so that, well, I've learned how to hear and understand and say these words. Now I want to be able to make sure that I also know the characters. And so I want to be able to, practice that. And so for some languages, it's very useful for like Chinese. For some languages like Spanish, it might be too easy because it's spelled out phonetically. Mm-hmm. But maybe getting the accents right is still a challenge. So we've developed those basically just because of we listen to our customers and what they want, and not every feature that they ask for we're able to develop and build. Some are a little bit complex, but a lot of things we're able to roll out for them. Yeah,
it's pretty cool. Like, so it's a way of
a lot of people are asking for search functions and being able to have more control of the sentences, and it's something that I would like to have as well myself. And I know how difficult of a programming job that is, and so it's a large project, and we need to hire, grow the team a little bit so that we don't spread our resources too thin. Yeah.
Right. So just to clarify, if I were to start Glossika for the first time today after listening to this, you've got the main training program, the one that does the reps. So would you say that if the language has these supplementary features, would you say that one can safely ignore them if you're a little bit busy or you don't have much time? Or would you say that it would be a really good idea to move a little bit between the two of them just to mix it up a bit or vary it? Like, what would be a good strategy there?
Well, I use Glossika, and I actually rarely use any of those other supplementary modules below, mainly because I know that I'm going to get the best practice out of the session, the actual training session. And the way that I use the session is that I actually turn it off. I use it on my cell phone. I go out. In my morning routine is usually I go out running and I go to the gym for about an hour and I'll use it during that time. And I don't even look at the screen. Now, when new sentences come on, maybe I just need to pause and take a look at some of the new sentences that come on somewhere around near the end of the training period for that day. I'll take a look at some of the new sentences and make sure that I see it visually and I understand what's happening there. And then I'll just put it back in my pocket and continue. Mm-hmm. And just keep going. I've seen them once and, you know, that's fine. Not really interested in being able to spell everything correctly, you know, because I think for me, my own personal goal, which may differ from other people. Some people, they might want to be able to spell English correctly. And so they want to make sure that they're doing all those games and practices and doing it specifically. But for me, I just want to be able to, for some languages, I just want to be able to understand. And I think the understanding is a major big step towards speaking later. So I may not even be repeating everything that I hear. I just want to be able to understand what people are saying in that language. And so that I feel like I can keep up with the conversation. And then maybe at some point in the future, I'll have enough confidence to actually start speaking if I'm ever in that situation.
Of course.
But I think one of the interesting things about Glossika is that I've sat in the recording sessions for so many languages, including the Danish that we recorded, and it takes a couple days, you know, 2 or 3 days. And but even going through the Danish, I think I felt like by the end of that session of just recording and just listening to all the sentences once through and checking with the sheet, making sure we recorded everything correctly, I'm starting to understand a very big portion of Danish. Now, a week later, I forget it all. But it's just fascinating that we're by the end of that recording session, I'm understanding, I couldn't possibly say anything yet, but I'm understanding maybe 70 to 80% because the sentence structures are there and the vocabulary, some of it matches some German, some of it matches some English. And so I feel like I can actually hear the language, I can hear the meanings jumping out of this, the sounds of the language. And so I've sat through the sessions for Slovene and Croatian and Slovak and Polish and Belarusian and a lot of these Lithuanian and Latvian as well. And I just felt like you can really start to hear the meanings come out by the end of, you know, 2 or 3 days of sitting. So I think, you know, just sitting there and doing it intensely for a few days really, really helps.
Like a silent period kind of thing. I've heard some people talk about that in the beginning.
If I had done more than 3 days on any one of those languages, I think I'd be understanding quite a lot of spoken dialogue in just a relatively short period of time. And so I think that in some way, it's actually possible for any one human to probably understand up to 100 languages or more in the world in his lifetime. But to achieve real fluency and mastery of a language, you may only have a handful, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 languages in your lifetime that you can really achieve true mastery. But you could, I think it's theoretically possible that you could understand maybe 100 languages in your lifetime. You know, yeah. if you have a system that's good enough that trains you with the audio, like we're doing. And so I think that one of these days we're probably going to end up with a customer that has incredible listening ability in a lot of languages.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, especially there's so many similar languages as well. I can definitely see that happening. And if somebody really has a good productivity for doing it every day on a regular basis, then can't see why not. I mean, it should be possible. I mean, of course, you have to get to 100 languages on Glossika. I know you have a lot of them at the minute. What's it, 50? 50 plus, but you need to add a few more to get to the 100.
Well, we built those the hard way. There's a much easier way to do it, and so we're building the platform to do that. Mm. And once we have that platform, we'll be able to go out to 300, 500, 1,000 languages much easier. And so the current way we're doing it is it's really manual and really intensive. And so there's a much easier way to do it. So. Yeah, I think, you know, 100 languages. I think, you know, right now, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, totally.
Okay, so I think we have a few more to roll out, Central Asia, maybe India, Sub-Saharan Africa. And then, of course, there's a lot of interest in the revitalization of languages. Hopefully, you know, people are asking. We get requests all the time. Greenlandic, Navajo, Nahuatl. Quechua,
right?
Guarani. They're asking for a lot of the New World languages. You know, Cree or Ojibwe. You know, Lakota,
Klingon. You know,
they have small communities of Native American speakers and Cherokee, and so I think that. You know, our team may not have the ability to actually develop these languages the old way. So we really need a new system to assist the teachers and to assist the community of people out there who want to put their content onto Glossika. And so this is really a tool for community. Where they can collaborate and work together and actually build it, and then Glossika is just the medium. We deliver the language. We can break it down into its its components and figure out how it works and let the algorithms do their job. But then it delivers it in a way that it's easy to start learning a language from the very first step, and you get the easiest parts, you know? And so that's what we want to do. And so we would have, you know, the A1 content would be fleshed out with all of this content. It would be easy for them to get through it and build up their basic abilities for the community, you know? That's we have really some cool test runs with some of the local languages where I live here. We have some indigenous languages that I mentioned earlier. And so there's a kind of a test bed for that. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So that's kind of like the future of where it's going. It's going to be more of a platform, a more versatile platform to put more on. And I guess that would also allow you to continuously update the old languages instead of having to hire the recording studio every year or every 6 months.
The other thing is this, is that our core team, we do not have the resources, the ability to keep adding languages to the platform. And so it just doesn't make sense because there is no business model for that. But we do have a lot of customers that want content for things like French and German and Spanish. And so that's where most of our focus is. And so we're adding content continuously to all of our major languages. I would say that there's more than a dozen languages that we're adding content to continuously. Mm. And so that's really important because people are reaching stages of like B2 level and C1 level, and they're running out of content. There are actually more categories where you can choose categories on Glossic. And some of those categories are lacking a lot of sentences. So we're adding in more and more content to those categories. And just really, you know, I think that a few years ago when we had the books, there were about 3,000 sentences in those books. And now on some of our languages, we're getting close to 10,000 sentences.
Wow. That's a lot.
And so they're really split up over all of the different levels. So, you know, you're going to have a really nice amount of content on whatever level you're in. But you can also skip that content by using the feedback inside of the system, telling us how you felt about the difficulty level. And so we can actually pass you on to the next skill in the skill tree, along that path. So you can actually, you know, if A1 is actually still kind of too easy for you, but there's so many sentences you have to get through, but you can actually pass over them quickly by just giving us the right kind of feedback. That's all automated,
customized. So
it helps every person move along at their own pace, at their own learning speed. Yes.
I think that's cool. Instead of having to go through all the levels and unlocking like some apps do, you know, you have to go through it. Or they have like these really ridiculous tests where if you make 3 typos, then suddenly you don't know the language anymore or something, you know. Yeah, good luck typing in like Russian or like spelling in languages that you just started learning. It's quite a stretch, you know. It doesn't mean you don't know anything. It's just that particular word you didn't know if it was A or O, you know. It's a bit ruthless that way. But I like your idea about having kind of the computer, the algorithm, figure it out as you go along dynamically. So
I tried out an app recently, maybe it was about a year or so ago, but I chose Russian. And so I was starting off with the app, and it asked me to type in the word for men in Russian. And I was thinking, this is level one. So I type in chelovek. I don't know. I think I made a mistake, or maybe it was the wrong word, because I do know a few words of Russian. And then just the first thing I got was wrong. Oh, this is not really building my confidence.
Encouraging, yeah. Yeah.
Not very encouraging.
No, but
I think it's okay for learners to be making those mistakes. And I think one of the hardest things for people learning Glossic at the beginning is that they think that they're supposed to memorize the sentence and they think they're supposed to get it right the very first time. And that's a wrong impression to have, because that sentence that you got on the first day, it's going to show up many, many times. You have many, many opportunities to get it right. And you don't need to memorize it, because after you've practiced it 20 times over the next 3 or 4 over the next week or 3 or 4 days, you're going to remember that sentence naturally. Mm. You don't have to do any extra effort. You don't need to turn off Glossika and then do homework. The whole point of this is that I personally hate homework. I never do my homework and I never revise and review. So the next time I do my session, I want to do my all of my revision and everything right there in the session. That's how we built it, because I know that people are busy, and by the time the next day they come back to it, they're going to forget everything. I know you're going to forget everything. That's why we built it like this.
Yeah.
Because we're going to help you just go over the material again and then add a little bit of new stuff. It's just so easy. It's so convenient. And I don't have to lay out my lesson plans or figure out what I'm going to learn next. It's all taken care of for you. So I think the greatest thing about Glossika is that I can go live my life and forget about all my language learning, and I can come back and just do a little bit every day, and it really just builds. Mm-hmm. And that review and revision, it really helps me learn everything without any extra effort. You know, keep the effort level low, but really high effect, you know, and results.
Yeah, and I think also I don't have any science to back this up, but I think we're more likely to remember things if we don't try to remember them. Like if we really focus on, it's kind of this like idea. I think when I did my driving lessons, it was about 12 years ago, I was driving and the instructor said, you have to focus your point of view on the road, the middle of the road in front of you, you know, the middle of your lane. If you focus on the oncoming traffic, then you're, hands are automatically going to, you know, steer towards it. So to me, it's interesting that, you know, we don't want to crash, of course, but sometimes if you focus on the thing that you want or that you don't want too much, it kind of just makes it a lot harder. And I think for the memory, it cannot feel like you're trying to remember, because then it will do anything it can to not remember it probably. You know, I don't have any science for this. I wish to, if somebody has any,
there's a little bit of science behind this.
Any ideas, that would be great.
There's a little bit of science behind this. And most of our memories go through a piece in the brain called the hippocampus. And so when a memory is created, it normally has these connections between the neurons and cells in the brain. And so there's something called an anchor, it's just a convenient word that we have. But if you experience something happening that becomes part of your long-term memory, normally that if you have sight and sound and smell and touch and all of these other things, they all create an individual anchor. So more connections with that cell or that group of cells that create that memory. And so those connections, the more connections you have, the deeper ingrained it is in your brain. So, for example, if you do experience a car accident, you're going to have a lot of anchors in there and a lot of trauma involved with that. So it actually stays in your memory a lot longer than, let's say, the kind of food you had for lunch yesterday,
right,
which you will easily forget. Was it a sandwich? Was it a soup? I forget.
Right. Yeah,
but sometimes those flavors, like maybe the flavor of your grandmother's cooking or your mother's cooking, might stay with you for life. And so maybe in old age, you have that same flavor and you're like, wow, this is exactly like my grandmother's cooking. And so that creates a very strong anchor from early in life, you know, that stays with you for life. So we're able to identify very specific things later in life. And so there's an interesting parallel here with language learning, is that building up those anchors and then actually strengthening the cells in the brain to remember, normally that just happens with exposure.
Yeah.
So you can create a stronger connection with more exposure, as long as it's exposure that's meaningful and it's something that you understand. So if it's a meaningful exchange of information, then you're more likely to remember it longer. Especially if you build in that muscle memory with the tongue, then you're building an extra anchor, because the muscle moving in combination with the sound is the best way to build that long-term memory with language, and that works towards fluency, because fluency is embedded in the muscle. It's not embedded in the eyes. It's not embedded in the knowledge of the brain. Fluency is in the muscle. So you have to move the muscle if you're going to get to fluency. And so, I mean, it's okay. You don't have to practice with your tongue, but you can get to the point where you understand a lot of things. But You repeat out loud. It just really helps to move the tongue along with whatever you're you're listening to, no matter how much mumbling it is, because it gets better. It gets better. It gets much better, and it improves very quickly.
Yeah. It, practice makes perfect, I think, is the kind of the conclusion to our discussion here.
Yeah, you really don't even need somebody to fix your pronunciation that all that much, because well, we're always going to have some accent in a foreign language, but the more practice you do, the better your pronunciation gets. And especially if you get outside and you speak with a native speaker. So if I meet with an Italian or a German or a Russian person and I'm speaking and I say something is just wrong, they're just going to look at me funny.
Yeah.
And then they tell me how to say it the right way. And I say, and that creates a very strong memory connection in my brain. And that experience will help me remember it. And I'm more than likely say it right the next time.
Yeah. Might still happen. But yeah, I mean, I think you should have your own podcast, Mike. You have such great, interesting inputs on the facets of language learning and the theories behind it. So that could be an interesting new the Glossica podcast with Mike. You know, people could listen into some of your musings on the different learning ideas. I think you should consider that.
Well, we do have a weekly video that goes out on the Glossica YouTube channel, and so. I invite people to ask questions because then I can address those questions with some information that I share every week. We may increase that to more than a week, but you know, it depends on how many questions we get. I mean, I could just sit there recording a lot of different things all the time.
Ask
but
Mike.
I try to keep it short. Try to keep it like maybe 3 to 5 minutes. So if you find a topic you're interested in, anybody out there listening and on the YouTube channel, Glossica YouTube channel, you can go ahead and sign up and we'll have new content coming out. Be sure to send us in questions and I'm always available to answer. And of course, Chris, you can always invite me back on. And if you have, maybe you pick up on topics from other people you interview and maybe you'd like to ask me what I think about it and vice versa, ask your other guests. But thank you very much.
No, you're very welcome. It's been a real pleasure, and I can't believe the time has flown by so quickly. It was really an interesting episode, and I also want to. I need to do more work. Every time I talk about methods and strategies, I always get excited to go back. So I might load up a little session of my Glossica hereafter. Do you have any last piece of information for people or? Places, website, URLs, anything you want them to check out. Of course, they can try out Glossica, tryglossica.com. You get the...
Right, you know, glossica.com. And yeah. Glossica with a K. It's from the Greek word for language, linguistics. So it's hopefully not too hard to remember. And just the website, glossica.com. You can sign up for free and you actually get free courses. If you actually sign in, we have some free languages in there. They're normally non-national languages, like a minority. So you can get Welsh and Scottish and Catalan and some Chinese dialects in there for free. And then we also have, you can try any of our languages for free. So there's that at least a week's worth of material in there for each language that you can try. So whatever you'd like to, it's fine.
Just to see if you get on with the method, because obviously we're all different.
It works for you or not.
Some people just respond a lot better to certain methods than others.
And a great thing is that if you've had maybe French in high school and it's been a few years, or maybe French in university and it's been a few years since you've practiced it, then... getting back on Glossica will bring the language back alive really quickly. And you might actually just recover what you've lost in a short amount of time and make a lot of new progress. And the great thing about that is that you've probably had a lot of grammar classes. You kind of know how the language works and how the grammar works. And what you really need right now is just that kind of, that voice, that audio training. And by doing that, you'll pick up a huge amount of the language in a very short period of time. So it really helps for those people that have had classes in the past and they haven't come back to the language in a long time. That's where you're going to make that's where Glossica gives people the biggest benefit. And the other thing is we've had stories from people where They learned the language as a child, or they heard their parents or grandparents speaking the language, but they never actually learned to speak it themselves. These people actually get a lot of progress in the language because they're familiar with it already. And so Glossika just really builds that expressive ability for them really quickly.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for being generous with your time today, Mike. It's been a real pleasure for me. And keep doing what you're doing. And maybe I'll see you sooner than 3 years for the next.
Sure.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.